Page two of your notes, we're going to get a little running start here of some things we've already covered. Evidence don't always win the loss, but God can use them in the process. So don't be afraid of them, but don't run off and think, if I have the right evidence, everybody's going to come to Christ. They are not needed to confirm our faith, but God can use them to help our faith, is the way I used it. But I mean, it can help, but it's not. Even if we never had an archaeological find, I still would believe the Bible is true, and I'd still believe in Jonah, et cetera, et cetera. But I like archaeology. I like history. I mean, it can help me a lot of ways. So we talked about that. So keep that balance, if you would. When it came to reliability, why do we believe the Bible is authoritative truth from God? And I chose those words, hopefully, carefully. It's authoritative, it's true, and it's from God. And we covered this. It's personal claim. The Bible claims to be God's word and to be true. That's what it says. Then we had Murray's quote, yet it might seem analogous to the case of a judge who accepts the witness of an accused in his own defense rather than the evidence derived from all the relevant facts in the case. Now, my question to you is, that's thrown at us. Abby, when I said, why do you believe the Bible? She says, because it claims to be true. And they, ha, ha, ha. That's like sitting in a court of law and the prosecuting attorney and the police officers have all this evidence that the guy's a murderer, and the judge turns to the man and says, are you a murderer? And he says, no. And he says, well, then you're off free. And for somebody to say, I believe the Bible is true because it says it's true, is like saying a guy's innocent because he says he's innocent. When all the evidence proves that he's not innocent, how is that analogy not good? There's a whole world of difference, isn't it? If in a court of law, all the evidence says this guy is a murderer, and he says, I'm not a murderer, what judge would say, oh, okay, I'll let you go? What this statement is saying is, implying at least, all the evidence points to the fact that the Bible is full of errors and it's not true and it's not from God. And yet you Christians believe it like it's true because it says it is. You're as dumb as a judge who, whatever, that is not a fair comparison. Is all the evidence pointing to the fact that the Bible is not true? It's full of errors, etc., etc. And what it also tells us is their responsibility, to some extent, to bring the evidence. We don't always have to be the ones to feel like it's guilty until proven innocent. It claims to be true. Now, if you think about the analogy he used about the murderer, do you know what our courts say? The courts say you are innocent until proven guilty, right? So if a prosecuting attorney says this guy is a murderer, the judge don't say, okay, murderer, you got to prove that you're innocent. That's not the way it works. So the analogy is actually backwards. It is saying all the evidence is stacked against us, and we have the responsibility to overturn it, or otherwise we look like a fool. The truth is, the Bible claims to be true. It has always claimed to be true. God's people have always claimed to be true. It's your job to prove us wrong. So go at it. And they have tied. Okay, and if you want to, of course, you can kind of believe whatever you want. So I don't think that's a fair analogy, and I hope we understand it. And I hope we're not ashamed. Well, why do I believe that the Bible is true? It is not a wrong answer to say because it says so. I don't have to hang my head, say, oh, I have blind faith. It does claim to be from God. And God's people through the ages have always said it. Now we have other things as well, okay? So it's personal claim. It's protected text. We talked about that, the unbelievable unity of it, the unbelievable preservation. Boy, you could spend hours and hours on that. It's phenomenal how unified it is, how well preserved. It's proven accuracy in history and science. We studied that last week. In prophecy is where we got to last time. And one of the great examples that will be found in most of the books that you study is fulfilled prophecy. And I'll just pick the one that probably is the most common. It's in Ezekiel in chapter 26. You have probably heard this, undoubtedly heard this before. It says in Ezekiel chapter 26, verse 4 and 5, they shall destroy the walls of Tyre, break down her towers, I will also scrape her dust from her and make her like the top of a rock. It'll be a place for the spreading of nets in the middle of the sea. For I shall plunder, for I have spoken, says the Lord, it shall be the plunder of the nations. Later on in that chapter it says, they will plunder your riches, pillage your merchandise, they will break down your walls, destroy your pleasant houses, they will lay your stones, your timber, your soil in the midst of the water, and I will put an end to the sounds of the songs in your streets. And if you study history, if you go back a little ways, in verse 7, for example, talk about Nebuchadnezzar. So it's talking about the city of Tyre. And you go back in history and you find this is what happened. That Nebuchadnezzar was a powerful guy, as you all know. And he came up against Tyre. Tyre was like Carthage. It was like the port for the whole region. It was a crucial, crucial city. And Nebuchadnezzar came up against it. He was there 13 years trying to take it. And he didn't take it. And he didn't destroy it. He never could take it. So if you read on one side, this prophecy is false for many reasons. Number one, Nebuchadnezzar never did destroy Tyre. It still exists to this very day. You can take a plane and fly there and get off and drive a bus and see it. Ouch. So many people, this is from somebody who doesn't believe the Bible is true, who says this is a clear proof that the Bible is full of errors because there's a prophecy about Nebuchadnezzar destroying Tyre, wiping it flat, becoming a place where the nets are spread, and you can walk there and you can see it today. Now, if you read D.J. Kennedy or Josh McDowell or the other ones, you'd find a different record, okay? What you'd find is this. Nebuchadnezzar never did destroy the city. He was there 13 years, couldn't take it down, couldn't siege it. So he left. But years and years later, there's a guy by the name of, let's see, Alexander the Great. And when he was chasing the Persians in his initial conquest, he came down the coast. The Persians were coming south down the coast of the Mediterranean Sea there. And then they took off to the east. But Tyre was a crucial port. And so Alexander the Great was covering his back. He was taking all the ports as well and making sure they were his. He came against Tyre, and something had happened. The people of Tyre, under the siege of Nebuchadnezzar, since they realized once in history this is not a good place, even though they survived it, they went out to a little island, a half mile out, and there they built a new city, the new city of Tyre. Alexander came there. The old city was broken, or was sitting there. And out there, a half mile, was the new city of Tyre with a new port and all that kind of stuff, so you know the account. He personally joined his troops in carrying all the stones, and he made a causeway out that half mile. And he went out there and he made that causeway and eventually took the city of Tyre. And they destroyed it. They laid the existing city of Tyre flat. The one on the island is the one they took. They didn't flatten that because they didn't have to, but they took that existing city of Tyre, they flattened it because they picked up every stone they could get. Every timber. Remember I read that? Every stone, every timber, every whatever. And they brought it out to make this causeway, and they moved it out there. And that part of the city was laid flat by Alexander the Great. They scraped the dust of it. They used the timbers, everything else, exactly as Ezekiel said, and they still lay their nets there, and it is not there today. Another city of Tyre, the new one, was rebuilt and is there. So the prophecy, from my perspective and our perspective, is perfectly fulfilled. All right? But if you want to deny it, obviously, and if you go on the internet, you'd find it's probably 50-50. Everybody wants to go to that one and prove it's either true or false. All right? But fulfilled prophecy. 2,000 prophecies, someone said, 2,000 prophecies have already been fulfilled, and everyone has been fulfilled about, you know, like 95% accurate or something like that, maybe. Right? 97, maybe? 100%. All right? I have some other ones here. Samaria and Jerusalem in Jeremiah 24:29. That's a classic one because it talks about Jerusalem is going to be laid flat, Samaria, et cetera, et cetera, and it's fulfilled. You could read that in Kennedy or McDowell or whatever. One of the great ones is the birth of Christ. I have a little booklet that's always been intriguing. I don't have no clue. Prophecies of the centuries that were fulfilled in a day, you know. At the birth of Christ, you know how many prophecies were fulfilled? A virgin shall be with child. Hey, that one was fulfilled. He'll be born in Bethlehem. Hey, that one hit. And you could fill in later on, in his death, they shall pierce his hands. There are just tons of prophecies about the Lord Jesus Christ that were fulfilled in his lifetime, many of them at his birth, a whole host of them at his death, and they were all fulfilled. And so the accuracy of prophecy, I hope you understand that's a tremendous confirmation of the truthfulness, the authority, the from-Godness of the text. Okay. Yet, the attack never goes away. And we have to realize that. We could have all the evidence in the world, and there's still going to be some guy who gets on the internet and tries to prove Tyre was not destroyed, da-da-da-da. Okay? The reason why, this is this, to be fair to ourselves in the Bible, we should read it through. Remember, that's one of the keys. If they really push you, just say, well, why don't you read it, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Because it is that. The last one there, why do we believe the Bible is authoritative truth? And of course, there's depending on how you outline it, could be 1,000 reasons. I just put it into these four and kind of grouped them together. But the last one is power to impact. Most people would tell you that one of the reasons we do believe it is true is the fact that it has power in itself. Here's the quote from somewhere. A skeptic said, it's impossible to believe any book whose authority was not known. A Christian asked him if the compiler of the multiplication table was known. He said, no. Then, of course, you do not believe in it. Well, I believe in it because it works. Well, so does the Bible. You know, so you can see some of it's philosophical. If you don't want to believe it, you're going to come up with these arguments. And most of those arguments, you can turn right around on them. And it goes like that. Martin Luther is one of my heroes, as you know. The Bible is alive. It speaks to me. It has feet, it runs after me. It has hands, it lays hold of me. You ask me how I know he lives? He lives within my heart, kind of thing. You want to know why I believe the Bible is true? It claims it's true. It matches. There's no evidence that I have found that really destroys it. Now, there's some things we haven't proven. There's some prophecies that haven't been fulfilled yet, but you don't have any evidence that it's full of errors. Near as I can tell, scientifically, historically, prophetically, etc., on and on it goes. So hopefully that will help us with that. Now, when it comes to the Bible, a current attack, perhaps in some ways the most popular, is the attack on what we call the canonicity of the Scriptures, the 66 books. But let's think about it. Why do you believe there are 66 books in the Bible? We call it the Gnostic Gospels, okay? And you could read, in fact, I have, if you really like to read about it, I have some articles here and I got copies of them, you may do it. You would find, they're called the New Gnostic Gospels. They're not new, but let's study it, okay? They were discovered at Nag Hammadi, Egypt, in 1945. They were like, remember the Qumran texts that were discovered and things? Well, Egypt's the same way. It basically never rains in Egypt, ever. So the only water they get is the Nile, and that's where they live, and that's where they irrigate. So they would just have to have a library with their parchments somewhere up in the sand dune up there, which isn't very far from the Nile, and they were safe. And somebody, and his name was Muhammad Ali, but he wasn't a fighter, in 1945 found these 60 or 59, I think, jars, and inside it were all these scrolls. And with time, somebody found him and who knew what he was looking at and says, ah, okay. They were popularized in the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown and some of his other works, as you know. They are academically defended by Elaine Pagel, who is a very popular writer from Harvard, I think it is, Divinity School. I'm pretty sure she's from Harvard, okay. And it's Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, all right. It's academically defended by people like her, who are bigwigs, very important people at Harvard Divinity School, Yale Divinity School, Duke, whatever it is, okay? Gary Cohen, who writes for Zion's Fire, which is a conservative group, says the greatest attack against the historic Christian faith in the last century is this one, okay? Because now you watch TV and documentaries and on it goes. They're always talking about the Gnostic Gospels and the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of this and the Gospel of that. I want you to be exposed to that's the attack, and they're saying these things. Let's just read through a few things here. They're just facts. The Gospel of Thomas is one of them. There are 114 sayings of purported discussion between Jesus and Thomas. Non-believers suggest it was hidden by the early church because they wanted to present their own version of Christ. And as Shane said, I think it was Shane who said, the impression you read from a Elaine Pago or a Dan Brown or whatever is this, okay, there was all these writings about Jesus. Okay, and the early church had all of them, and they had to sit down one day and they say, okay, which ones we're going to put in the Bible? Well, we can't put in the one about Thomas because, you know, it's kind of pro-feminine, and we don't want women to be in the church, so we're going to keep him out, and we can't put in this one because it's whatever. And so they pick and chose, and they end up with, for the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They left out the Gospel of Thomas. Let's go to the next one, the Gospel of Judas. The Gospel of Judas, National Geographic, said it's an alternative view of the Jesus-Judas relationship. As you have studied, you realize that according to this gospel, Judas was a good guy. And in some ways, if the gospel is true, it almost makes Jesus the bad guy. Because Judas and him had this little agreement, said, okay, we got to get you to look really good, so I'm going to pretend that I betray you. All right, we're just going to have this great scheme. I'm going to betray you and pull this off, and I'm going to look like the bad guy so that you can be lifted up and exalted, and then we're going to pull you out of the grave, and you're not going to really die and resurrect. We're going to push that one across the people, and it's this whole scheme. And Judas is a good guy. None of the other disciples knew it. Him and Jesus had this secret pact, and to make Jesus look good, Judas took the fall. All right, so you have that. You have the next one, the Secret Supper, which includes a bunch of things, but one of which is Mary Magdalene saw Christ's body of light, not his resurrected body. She decided to steal his physical remains and hide them in her house, where she carefully embalmed them and took them with her to France when the persecutions began. I mean, it's just bizarre when you read it. It's just like so different than anything you've read in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, and if you read the Da Vinci Code with Dan Brown, and so you get some of this flavor about these secret groups that are carrying on what Mary Magdalene did, and Jesus really didn't die, and they carried his body to France, and he buried him, or he had kids through Mary Magdalene, and that kids go on, and whatever it is. Let's go back to the Gospel of Thomas and think this through. Did the early church have an obligation? They claim that early church did not publish the Gospel of Thomas. They hid it. Because they had this scheme to keep us from the truth about Jesus as he really was. If you're going to really read about Jesus, you should read all the biographies, not just four that the church picked, all right? So the early church hid them in these things and threw them away in the desert and didn't tell you about it until 1945, somebody discovered them. The question that I would ask, Cohen asks, is this. Did the early church have an obligation to publish what they considered to be a non-canonical, later, false gospel? In other words, because they didn't publish it, are they bad guys? Did they have some obligation to publish every book that ever, you know, where did they come up with that? They had no obligation to publish every false gospel. When they use false gospel, part of that's because it came a lot later. It wasn't written like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John by an apostle or one of his followers. That's a lot later. In fact, you go to the Gospel of Judas, carbon dating, if you go down a couple lines, carbon dating is between 220 and 340. Therefore, it cannot be apostolic. So it's a later book. If you read it, that one's in direct contrast to the account of the four Gospels. Did Christ take part in this elaborate deception? It's just everything had to work out right as far as the crucifixion. He didn't really die. They put him in the grave. They ran away with his body, revived him, you know, the whole nine yards. I mean, him and Judas had this masterful scheme worked out. And you could almost, if it's true, you could almost say Judas was the good guy and Jesus was an elaborate deceiver. So if that's true, why would I ever follow somebody named Jesus, who pulled off this great scheme to trick me into thinking he was really resurrected from the dead and make me follow him and all these people through all the ages that followed this great deceiver. The next question, even if God used the evil schemes of wicked men, they always say, well, God uses the evil scheme of wicked men. for his good. The evil ones are still wicked, all right? So my point is that it's out there. You're going to read it. You're going to see it on PBS. You're going to see it in movies like The Da Vinci Code or whatever it is that you watch, and it's out there. So we have to answer that question. They're asking you, why do you believe there's only, you know, this is the Bible? Because now they feel like your unsaved friends, if they're anti-God and anti-Bible and whatever, they feel they have ammunition. Elaine Pagel, she's a leading scholar on this from Harvard Divinity School. And, you know, Dan Brown wouldn't lie and, you know, whatever. And if you've seen PBS things, you realize they always try to be neutral. You know, listen to both sides, and somehow it doesn't come out neutral. But anyway, what they have done, even if they can't prove that Dan Brown and Elaine Pagel are right, what they've done is successfully planted seeds of doubt. Enough to say, if you didn't want to believe the Bible, you say, well, I can't believe it. I don't know for sure, but, I mean, there's really smart people who don't think, you know. So they have successfully planted in the minds of us as American people and Europeans and whatever, this great, great thing. That every account is equal, because every account is written by who? A man. And no accounts are inspired. That's a huge difference, isn't it? If you believe that this book was inspired, and then a whole bunch of other guys wrote a whole bunch of heretical things, you know, that's different than if you say, well, if you don't believe in inspiration, which the liberals don't, then obviously they, well, Matthew wrote one, and Mark wrote one, and Thomas wrote one, and Judas wrote one, so how do you know which one's right? And if you didn't believe in inspiration, you'd say, I don't know. Okay? Here's another thing. Let's try to put it together. How did we get the canon? Because that is a great question. Why 66 books? Why not the Shepherd of Hermes is a great work? Why don't we consider that one of these books? Now, the Gospel of Thomas and Judas, they're like off the wall, you know. But some of the other ones aren't that bad. The Gospel according to Barnabas. Okay? So why aren't they? Paul, we know, wrote four letters to Corinth. I mean, he tells us that in the book of 1 and 2 Corinthians. Only two of them are inspired, and the other two, we have no clue where they are. But if we could find them tomorrow, why would we not say they were God's Word? You think the only books Paul ever wrote were the ones that we have? I mean, how do we come up with 66? So here's the thrust of it. You've got to get this straight, okay? Because if you're going to explain it to them or give them an answer, you got to know what you're going to say, all right? Rob Bell, this is the Emergent Church. Rob Bell, Mars Hill, Grand Rapids, Michigan. It wasn't until the 300s that what we know as the 66 books of the Bible were actually agreed upon as the Bible. How many believe that? 325, Council of Nicaea. Constantine, the emperor, the first Constantine the First, who was now a Christian, said, we got to settle all this. We got to get our act together, guys. So he brought all the theologians together, the bishops of various churches in Nicaea. He said, okay, we're going to settle this issue about whether Jesus was fully God and fully man. That was the Arian controversy. We're going to settle the question of what are the books of the Bible, okay? Because by 325, there were all kinds of gospels and everything else, okay? So they had this great council, and they ended up saying Christ was fully God and fully man. They said there are 66 books that we call the Bible. And therefore, the conclusion of guys like Rob Bell, who went to a seminary that I almost went to, and came out of a church that I would have gladly pastored many years ago. I mean, a guy like that, raised in one of our homes, comes to the conclusion, I can show you the quote, page whatever it is, that it wasn't until the 300s that we finally agreed on the 66 books. Is that right? Because if that's right, they have a real good case. That until 325, and then in 367, Athanasius confirmed it again, and he had the same 66 books. And you could have Origen and some of the other guys who've made hints about it, but you know, it was never questioned after 367 in the established church until the Catholics brought in the Apocrypha a little bit later, all right? So here's the way you got to look at it, okay? Were there all these books out there, and everybody's like, I wonder which one's the Bible? What do you think, Dean? Which one to use? And Shane, which one? Hey, Virgil, which one are you using? What do you think? And we were these confused Christians for 325 years trying to figure out which book it was. And finally, we just said, okay, guys, we just got to call the shot. You know, we got to make a book out of it. So let's sit down at Nicaea and figure it out. And after we got all done, we decided. These 66 books of the Bible. Is that how it happened? Did the church determine what books they wanted in the Bible? That's the impression I'm going to leave. Constantine 325, the church finally said, well, we want these and these, you know. So it's kind of like a scheme, almost despicable what they did, because they didn't like this one, it was two whatever and two whatever. So they kind of picked and chose what they wanted and they ran with them and they've been fooling us ever since, you know. Or did the church finally feel the need to set in writing what had been accepted from the start and which was now being attacked as error? And it's the second one. You know, all along, somehow God was able to show God's people what was truly His Word. All right? And Matthew was always accepted as an inspired gospel, and Mark and Luke and John and whatever. So the church had always accepted them. They had never written them down because why write a list? You know, we all know what they are, you know. But now attacks and errors are coming in, and some guy shows up with the Gospel of Thomas, and he says, I think this one's inspired too. And then Constantine forced the issue because he became the emperor, and he became a Christian. And he says, now we got to, you know, whatever. And they have the Arians and the heretics and all these other things going on. So finally the church said, okay, we have to take a stand on what has always been accepted to be true and has been attacked as an error. You see the difference? And I think that's why the liberals think they make us look dumb. Don't let them. We, as a church, did not determine what were the inspired works of God. We didn't determine it. God determined it. We didn't pick and choose. God wrote him, and they were accepted right from the start. Peter knew what Paul was writing was inspired. You can read that, right? They knew what was there, and then when the error came in, they finally had to settle it and take care of it. Here's another thing. When do we write a doctrinal statement or add to it as a church? It's the same thing as what you said with standard operating procedure. You've been doing it and accepting it as standard operating procedure, but now you just got to formalize it. And a doctrinal statement is often written when there's a potential of error. It's not that we just, you know, suddenly thought up the virgin birth. Oh, we believe in a virgin birth. We never did before, so we wrote it up. We always did. But when we're under attack, we say, we better write it down so everybody knows what we believe. Okay. Don't forget as well. I mean, hopefully that helps you in some ways. At least be exposed to it. And they would say, you've been hearing about it for some time now. It's all over the media. The horrible secret is out. Everyone has just learned that the Holy Bible was censored by the Roman Catholic Church in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. You can hardly turn on a talk show without someone repeating this claim. And they really think they got us on this one. And this is the greatest attack in our day on the authority and the truthfulness of Scripture. And if you're going to stand up and they say, why do you believe the Scripture? You can be sure, if they're a thinking person walking around in our world, they're going to throw this at you. And when I interacted with one of the professors at UNI, immediately it was this. What do you do with those things that they founded in Egypt in 1945? How come the church hid them? What do you mean they hid them? You know, you better be ready and have an answer. So turn it on them, okay? The church did not determine what were inspired words of God in 325. The church had always believed them, and when error came in, they said, we got to write it down So we take our stand. So that, you know, they didn't create it. It was created by God. Okay, we got to go on. There's one last line there. Why do we believe the Bible? Don't forget self-authentication. And I just really want you to believe that. Part of the reason I think that you and I believe the Bible is the authoritative truth of God is we have read it, we have studied it, it has impacted our life, it was living and powerful, it is self-authenticating. And I wish a man by the name of Dr. Jim Greer could be here. He's an older man now. I wish he could come to our church and just speak once, because he is so profound in the fact the Bible is self-authenticating. It is. And when you're dealing with people, if you really get hung up, just say, well, why don't you go home and read it? Why don't you go home and read it? Because most of the people who are claiming whatever it is have never read it. We got to move on. If you want copies of these articles, by the way, they're up here on the New Gnostic Gospels. And it is a current thing. You can just go on the Internet. Let's go to the next issue. Hopefully we can cover it tonight. And that's regarding creation. Why do you believe the universe was created? Now, we could deal with science, the flood, a thousand things. There's so many things we could cover. I just want to quickly summarize the views, what some people call naturalism or secular evolution. You understand that? Scientific evolution, whatever. Some people believe in poetic creation, which is really theistic evolution, that there was an evolution and then God just kind of wrote it in Genesis in a poetic way to kind of sound nice to us. But in reality, it wasn't 6 days. In reality, you know, it wasn't in this order. It was the account of Genesis 1 and 2 is poetry with poetic license. And so Merle Unger, who wrote a great dictionary and a great Bible concordance and so, or not concordance, but handbook, said the scientists can be wrong, they just can't be that wrong, you know. So it is really hard. Now, Tim Keller, many of you know the name Tim Keller. He's very popular. He's from New York City. He has a large, large, large church right there in Manhattan. He's considered a very conservative guy. And a lot of people are, it's like John Piper, Al Mohler, Tim Keller. You know, he's on that level, John MacArthur. Many conservative are young guys are listening to Tim Keller. Joel knows all about him. Just go to seminary. And he just come out, he's not in a strict sense a creationist. So it will never go away, guys. We have not won the battle, okay? Poetic creation just says it's poetry. It's creation in a sense of poetry, but in reality there was an evolutionary process where God was controlling. That's why it's called theistic evolution. Progressive creation says something like there's creation, God did this, and then a whole era of time went by, an age or an eon or whatever, and then he did the next thing, and then a whole age went on. So that allows for, now we're getting a little cold in here, aren't we? You can crank that up a little bit. We went from freezing to frying to freezing or something here. Anyway, you have that view, that, and it's an attempt to believe in creation without denying what the scientists say, okay? And the long periods of time, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have the ruin and restoration creation, which is really the gap theory, if you know about. Yes?
By the way, that progressive creation is in Scofield.
It is. Yep. So that you'll find, especially 40, 50, 60 years ago, some very, what we would call conservative Bible scholars, Unger, Scofield, whatever, were not six-day creationists. Okay, they were either poetic, progressive, or this next one, rule and restoration, which is the gap theory, which is to say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Huge gap of time. Huge gap of time. And that whole world that he created went into evil, and finally God totally destroyed it. And then out of that, he recreated, and the account from that point on in Genesis 1 is the recreation of the destroyed world that had happened. So it's called the gap theory. Scofield would have that in his Bible as well. Okay, now it's very, very popular, and before some of us today who haven't heard about it might laugh about that, like, who would ever believe that? But really be careful if you interact with some guys who are about 80 years or so, old or so, because that was very popular. That was probably the predominant view in our circles. It was taught in regular Baptist press 40 years ago, 50 years ago. Okay, so Schofields and Ungers and whatever. So, you know, be a little careful to mock before you mock that one, in the sense of there might be some people who still believe that, right? Okay. I think most of us would realize that we believe in biblical creation, and what it says is what it means. At least I do, and I think most of you do. Sometimes we divide up on this. Some people are scientific creationists and some are biblical creationists. By that I mean some people have come to this conclusion because science has pointed them there, and some have come to this conclusion because the Bible has pointed them there. I'm not sure there's a big difference there, but some people make it out. So those are the views. Why do I believe in creation? Relatively short age, et cetera, et cetera. You can read a lot of books. Again, this is so much fun. I don't know. If you're like me, I just enjoy this, but you can go on and on and on. So I'll just list a couple of them. Number one, uniformitarianism. Who can tell me what that is? Uniformitarianism. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 4, since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Uniformitarianism says everything has continued in a uniform pattern throughout time. Now, I didn't quote all of 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 4, because the truth is it doesn't say that's the right position. It says there are going to be mockers in the last time saying this and this and this, and they will say, because the mockers of us will say, because all things continue as they were from the beginning of time. So you go to Mammoth Cave and you see stalactites and stalagmites, and they are growing at, you know, 1 inch every whatever hundreds, thousands of years, right? You can't even touch them. They're growing so slowly. So you look at it and it's growing, okay, at this rate it's going to grow 1 inch in 5,000 years. And the thing's this big. So you do the math and you go, that cave is so many years old. Right? You just back it up. What is required for you to back it up like that? Your assumption is that the rate of growth today is the rate of growth 10 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. It's always grown at this rate. It's never been faster, never been slower. It's always been the same. You look at Grand Canyon. You watch that river carve it out, and it's eroding so many tons of soil a year. You do the math. You see how much is missing. You see how much it takes every year. You do the math. It took 400 million years to erode that amount of... It's assuming that river has always been that size, always eroded at the same rate. It's never been faster, never been slower. It's always the same. So if you can prove uniformitarianism, then you can indeed extrapolate backwards, and you would be right. The Grand Canyon took 400 million years to carve out at that rate. Now, I didn't have a candle with me, so if I had one, I'd have one here. It'd be a short one, and I'd have it burning, and I'd say, now tell me, how long was this candle when I started it? And your answer would be, I don't know. Why not? You have no clue of what it was like in the past. All you can see is what is. You got a snapshot of now, and to say it's eroding at the rate of a quarter of inch every hour. Let's see, I can move it back. That thing must have been 10 foot long. You don't know. You're making huge assumptions. Besides that, the assumption is everything's continuing as it is. What do we know from the Bible that would make that a false statement?
Flood.
The flood. In fact, you read, you've studied this, the Bible talks about five worlds, right? And in Peter it talks about the world that then was. So there was the created world, right? Then what happened in Genesis 3? There was a curse and a fall. We had a new world. Things changed, right? I mean, it was a different world. Then there was this huge flood. Read about that in Genesis chapter 6. And when it was all done, there was a whole new world. And Peter would talk about the world that then was. So there was a created world, the world between, the cursed world, the world after the flood. That's the world we live in yet. Okay? And then there's going to be a millennial kingdom, and that'll be a little different than what we have. The lion will lay down with the lamb, etc. And then there's the eternal in the new world. Okay? So, who's to say everything's continuing as it is? So you could read Whitcomb and others. This is a great book on it. I wish I could just take time to show you some of these petrified logs, and on it goes. What is the evidence that the world has always continued as it is today? And the proof is, it seems like, the opposite. Okay, we'll have some other ones. Time and chance. National Geographic said, I've quoted this in our services before, who knew? They used to have a section in National Geographic entitled, Who Knew? It was one of my favorite sections, all right? Anyway, you read through this, who would have known? All right? And as you read through this, Carl Sagan said, there are billions and billions of galaxies, each one utterly lousy with stars. And if stars are created or formed at the same rate throughout all of history as they are now, how long would it have taken for all these stars and billions of galaxies and whatever? So you go back. Bottom line is, we have now concluded the universe is practically infinite. And therefore, it is practically eternal. That's a strange thought. Who's infinite and who's eternal? Now we have the universe is practically. So, there is not one universe. Our universe is only one of many, many, many universes. And now the scientists are concluding the multiverse is infinite in space and eternal in time, or practically. And so their bottom line is? Well, all right, that's our bottom line. It just blows you away when you read through this. And their bottom line is, therefore, somewhere in this multiverse, there's another planet the same size and shape as the Earth, and it has the same everything the same as ours. There's a guy just like Virgil somewhere, sitting in a classroom somewhere, taking a class from some pastor somewhere. No, they're not. It blows you away. Time and chance, time and chance. Everything to them is time and chance. You could read, you've read this before, D.J. Kennedy, and where's his book? Anyway, you've read this. What are the probabilities of, these things? You've heard all those things, the probability of an amoeba being formed is one in, whatever. So the probability is zip. Okay, and you've all used the illustration of put all these letters in the thing and fling them in the wind and they fly out and you have Shakespeare's, King Lear. What are the, So they need so much time and so much chance that it has to be infinite in time to have infinite chance for this possibly to happen. All right? So it would seem to me that's another evidence against evolution for creation. The law of laws of thermodynamics. My chemistry teacher taught us that the day before Thanksgiving, I'll never forget it, in my freshman year. And the reason I remember it, because most of the kids had missed class. They were already gone home. He said, I'm going to give you the secret to the whole class, and everybody here is going to get an A from now on. So he said, the first law of thermodynamics is this. Water runs downhill. And he's right. It's called the law of energy. Everything goes from high energy to low energy. Water always runs downhill unless you put a pump on it and pump it back. The second law of thermodynamics is this. Your bedroom does not clean itself. Everything goes from order to disorder. Leave your house for 2 years and come back. It will not be cleaner. Right? And that's called the first one's the law of energy. The law of entropy is the second one. So everything goes from high to low energy. Everything goes from order to disorder. These are laws of thermodynamics. By the way, he said those two things and he sent us home. That's all I learned that day, but I never forgot it. He's right. So evolution says what? We're going to do it backwards here. those two laws would tell us what? Mankind is getting better or mankind's getting worser? And if you put a bunch of chemicals, they're going to suddenly form into this highly organized organism, or they're going to degenerate. You could study mutations, and so there are mutations. All mutations improve the species, right? All mutations do what? They degenerate the species. You can mutate a fruit fly, and you know what you have? You have a weird fruit fly. You don't have a better fruit fly. Now, we have genetic engineering, and I think that's a little different because they, you know, they've done something. But mutations and so, all right? So the law of thermodynamics would be against it. Let's just go to spontaneous generation. We're running out of time. If I got time, I'll come back to that. Genesis 1, you know, in the beginning, God versus the Big Bang, you know. Can there be something called spontaneous generation? Boom. Well, E equals MC squared tells you what? Can you create matter out of nothing? Can you get energy without matter? I mean, there's got to be some connection there, all right? So where'd the Big Bang come from? In other words, when they tell you that, you say, well, where'd that come from? Well, where'd that come from? Well, where'd that one come from? Oh, it came from amoeba and a pop. Well, where'd that come from? It came from, where did that one come from? And you back them up to a Big Bang or whatever they think is the start and say, well, where did that come from? Where was this energy? And it would seem like they run out of answers. Because everything in our scientific world tells us we have a closed system. You can't make something out of nothing. You can maybe transfer energy to matter and matter to energy, but you can't, whatever, okay? You could also study missing links. That's an interesting one if you read some of these books. Fossil records, they will try to intimidate you, like the fossil record. Remember the Nebraska man, the Piltdown man? And they found out the whole thing's, you know, hoax. On it goes. Mutations, on it goes. I think you've probably studied a lot of those. And if you haven't, I just encourage you to read books like The World That Perished. Josh McDowell has a lot of them. Not because, in a sense, you need that to believe in creation, but sometimes you feel intimidated when they say, well, the whole fossil record proves that whatever. Really? Read a scientist who's a Christian explain the fossil record, and you don't feel like you have to apologize for it, you know? You don't have to apologize for the Grand Canyon and that you believe it. You don't have to apologize for our position that God created the world a relatively short period of time ago. Because we're not fools. We really aren't. The evidence they think they have isn't really there. It's based on time and chance, uniformitarianism, and on it goes. One of the great proofs, by the way, of against uniformitarianism is under the Lincoln Memorial. You've all seen this probably. You ever been there? What's under it? How old is the Lincoln Memorial? 100 million years? What did you say? 100? Well, I thought it was 100 million. So I can get a picture of it. You know they have stalactites, and those are the ones from the top, right? Stalagmites are the ones from the bottom, I think. It was built in 1923. This photo was taken in 1968. They have stalactites that are over 3 feet long. So when you go to Mammoth Cave or any other cave and they show you, you know, it's growing at a 1 inch every whatever, who's to say it always grew at that speed? Who's to say that it couldn't have been? There was a time when water was just rushing through. That thing was growing like 4 inches a week, you know? You know, on it goes. You understand it. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3. You can read it there. Would you like to read it together? It's on the bottom of your sheet there. Because in the end, it's this. By faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. In the end, we still do it by faith. Okay? I love to read Jastrow. I've read this before. Page 62 of Pinnock. I almost have this memorized. It's one of my favorite. Jastrow is a great NASA scientist. Y'all remember he was in the leader of it for a while. His closing words are remarkable. Here's Jastrow. This is an exceedingly strange development, unexpected by everyone except those theologians. They have always believed the world of the Bible. But we scientists did not expect to find evidence of an abrupt beginning because we have had, until recently, such extraordinary success in tracing the chain of cause and effect backward in time. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise, and there's a space in there. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountain of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. He pulls himself over the final rock. I love this one. And he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. My grandson is only 5. He believes the word of God, world was created by God. And there are scientists at some very smart universities who don't. And my grandson's right. And he might not have good explanations always. But by faith, we believe the worlds were created by the Word of God. And you might feel intimidated at times. You might not have all the answers. They might throw something at you. You have no idea what uniformitarianism is, you know, or whatever, you know. But just be innocent like my grandson and believe it.